Operation George is a gripping true crime story of an audacious undercover sting, an untold previously and gripping story of how a Northern Irish terrorist and murderer and one of his followers were caught in an audacious and brilliantly executed undercover sting on the English mainland, codenamed Operation George. Here to tell us more about it is one of the authors of the book, Stephen Bentley. Good morning to you, Stephen. Hello, Stephen. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. Yes.
Thank you for just a slight technical hitch there. Good morning to you. Tell us a little bit about the background then to this to Operation George.
Well, the background is that it's a unique undercover investigation which resulted in the conviction and imprisonment of a Northern Ireland Loyalist volunteer force terrorists for a number of counts of murder and other terrorist-related activities. And that ended up being the longest trial in Northern Ireland to date. And he ended up with a minimum 25-year jail sentence, which he's currently serving. That's the background to it, the essential rub of what Operation George was all about. But it was a sting that was set up to ensnare a Northern Ireland terrorist, but that wasn't possible to do that in Ulster, in Northern Ireland. So a very elaborate sting was set up to lure him over to England from the United States, where he'd been arrested for immigration offences, firearms offences and drug offences. And in collaboration with the FBI, he was lured back to England through another LVF colleague of his who was then living in a B&B, a bed and breakfast in Plymouth in Devon. And he was lured back to Devon. And the bigger background to this was this character, by the way, his name was Jim Fulton, William James Fulton. He was an early suspect in the Rosemary Nelson murder inquiry, the prominent human rights solicitor that was murdered. There was a car bomb stuck underneath her car. She was murdered in 1999. So this was a spin-off from that murder investigation, which was based in Belfast. Well, there was no point in setting up a sting operation in Belfast because a load of English cops wouldn't have worked, undercover cops wouldn't have worked in Belfast. So, as I say, he was lured over to Plymouth in England, and the undercover police team posed as a criminal firm, a gang, an organised crime group, and they recruited Jim Fulton, first of all, as a driver, paying him wages as a driver, where they were asking him to take members of the gang, especially the leader of the so-called criminal gang, who was, of course, an undercover police officer, up to London on the pretext of visiting a bank and all kinds of shady goings-on in London. They were the initial contacts, the initial journeys with Fulton and the undercover officers. And over a two-year period, he was recorded, and those secret recordings were the basis of him being convicted at trial for 48 offences in total. So that essentially is the background.
I mean, presumably he was in the States, so he managed to get out of the States and come to England. How were his suspicions not raised how he could enter the UK so easily? Or is this, and excuse me, because this is complete layman's terms, you know, would he not have thought that he might get picked up coming back into the mainland Britain?
The bottom line, Charles, is he didn't have a choice because he'd been arrested in California on firearms and drugs charges, immigration charges, and he was deported. But that deportation was a kind of collusion between the FBI and the police back in Britain. And as soon as he was deported and he arrived at Heathrow, then he was given what's called in legal terms an Osman warning. It's a warning that British police have to give if they believe that the subject, in other words, Jim Fulton, has had a meaningful, a realistic death threat made against him. Well, he had back in the province back in Ulster, there were death threats, undoubtedly. So he was given this Osmond warning. The purpose of that Osmond warning really was to try and persuade him not to go to Belfast. But initially he did, because he joined up in Belfast with his wife and family. But that's when the other LVF colleague, a woman by the name of Muriel Gibson, she had an undercover police team embedded close to her, in first of all in Plymouth and then Cornwall. And hints were dropped that did she know anybody that might be interested in this bit of a shady character called Neil? Well, Neil was one of the undercover officers, and he was the so-called boss of the purported crime group in Plymouth. So Muriel Gibson, obviously over the telephone or whatever, made contact with Jimmy Fulton and told her about this opportunity of earning some money. You know, and it's a bit dodgy over there, Jimmy. Why don't you come over to England? And Jimmy Fulton did. And he was, inverted commas, recruited by this criminal firm, again, the undercover police officers, and he ended up working for them for 2 years. So when you say, was Fulton suspicious about how he got out of the United States and what happened when he got back to the UK, the answer to that has to be no, he wasn't suspicious because of, you know, it was a natural thing that he faced deportation because of these criminal offences in the United States.
And presumably, I mean, there weren't that many opportunities. He knew he had death threats against him in Belfast. He knew that there wasn't going to be much. He would be being monitored, I suppose, very closely as a suspect in the murder of Rosemary Nelson. So coming from somebody he knew and trusted, this would seem to be a bona fide opportunity to come in. And I suppose coming in as a driver rather than coming in as high level, because as a driver he wouldn't be privy to all the ins and outs. All he would literally do is take somebody a bit, you know, more senior to him in his gang to and from places. So looking at a bank would make perfect sense.
That's absolutely spot on what happened over the 2 year period is that he gained the trust of these operators in Plymouth, the undercover team posing as the gang, the criminal gang, and his role in the gang sort of developed over the 2 year period, where he was entrusted to do other things. I mean, a classic example of that is the scam that they set up with a so-called stolen work of art, a stolen Lowry, which wasn't stolen at all. It was a two-bob picture, you know, that you could buy on a market stall. But fortunately, Jimmy Fulton wasn't an art expert. So anyway, there was this sting set up, and the undercover officer's Belgian counterparts were drafted into this, where, they were supposed to be the potential buyers of this stolen work of art. And Jimmy was given the job in the hotel where the trade went off. Jimmy was given the job of patting them down for guns. And I can't do the Northern Irish accent, but he turned around to one of the undercover officers and said something like, "Now you're talking, this is right down my street," you know. So as time went by, the point is, as time went by, he developed in his role within the gang, and he became, you know, more than just a driver. You know, he was entrusted to slaughter, which is criminal vernacular for distributing stolen goods. He was trusted to slaughter, lorry loads of stolen booze and cigarettes that were in an industrial warehouse in the West Country. So, you know, his job, they gave him more responsibility as time went on. Of course, the more responsibility he had, the more he talked. And, of course, the more he talked, the more he was recorded and convicted himself out of his own mouth.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I've done interviews with officers who've gone undercover and joined criminal gangs and had to keep up their cover stories, you know, and that's hard enough as it is. But this, I feel like, flips on its head, because the entire criminal gang is under police officers, and it's only the main man himself who's the one who thinks he's in a gang, but in fact isn't.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, and that's why in the book I make references to the Truman Show and and make references to Lewis Carroll type, you know, similes down the rabbit hole, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so that's absolutely true.
I mean, how inventive did they have to be, the officers, to come up with these? I mean, the stolen Larry and getting Belgian officers involved as well. I mean, it is an elaborate sting, but obviously, you know, we wanted this man. We wanted him very badly indeed because of the cowardly killing that had been carried out by the organisation, the Loyalist Volunteer Force.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, they, obviously there was enormous cost involved, and the cost was obviously justified by the seriousness of the nature of the. I'm going to say allegations or allegation because it was set up in the aftermath of the Rosemary Nelson bombing, and of course, you know, that quite rightly attracted a lot of publicity on both sides of the Atlantic, both in Britain and Ireland and in the United States. So, you know, him being an early suspect, it justified the enormous cost of setting up the operation. The shame is, or when I say shame, I mean, you know, I've got to be fair, not once, and my co-author who was involved in Operation George, he would say the same, but not once did Jimmy Fulton make any kind of admission about an involvement in the Rosemary Nelson murder. And my co-author, Mark Dickens, that's a pseudonym, he's convinced that Jimmy Fulton wasn't involved in that particular murder. But we can't say the same thing about Jimmy Fulton's brother, who's now dead. His brother was also a prominent member and a leader of the LVF in Northern Ireland at one time. He's dead now. Mark Swinger Fulton, as he was called, there is some very, very strong circumstantial evidence that he was behind the bomb that blew up Rosemary Nelson's car.
I mean, when you get these situations as well, presumably, this is still based, so he's still based around Plymouth. Jimmy, at this point, is that where he's in Cornwall? This is a major. This is where he was based throughout the period of believing he's in a criminal gang.
Yeah, the gang was based in Plymouth, so therefore Jimmy was based in Plymouth. In fact, at one time, accommodation was arranged for him in Plymouth, and he ended up living in Plymouth with his wife and children. But you know, they were travelling everywhere. The gang members and Jimmy were travelling up and down the M4 corridor, up and down the M5 corridor. You know, they were paying regular visits to London, Southampton, Bristol, East London. There was a scam set up in Wapping in East London, where there was going to be an armoured car, a cash in transit robbery, but that was decided against because obviously firearms could be used in such a scam, and firearms and Jimmy Fulton didn't mix at all, so that was called off. They had a rethink about that, but that was one of the early scams that was planned. But the main scams were, besides the stolen work of art, the Lowry, were the thefts of lorry loads of high-value lorry loads of spirits and cigarettes and...
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, so Jimmy never became suspicious. This was all. I mean, it's meticulous place work because had they got too ambitious, like you said, and the possibility of Jimmy running around with the firearms would just be, you know, what could, you know, as the saying goes, what could possibly go wrong? But I suppose that level of, because that is, you know, the theft of spirits and those sort of goods is bread and butter, if you like, to a criminal organization. You know, quick turnover, easily done. You've got to, you know, you can easily fence it off, or, you know, sell it to unscrupulous into your network of your distribution network. And even the artwork would kind of seem to be that, you know, a little bit out of the ordinary, but, you know, that would keep him interested and show that the gang was going somewhere rather than just sort of tailing off and deciding to do his own thing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's correct. It is. It's you know, it was you know, if you're going to organise scams like that, the lorry loads of you know, high value goods like the spirits and cigarettes are relatively easy to get organised. Although some of the owners of the of the high-value goods, they insisted that the various chief constables actually insure those goods, and they were insured.
How did they run this by top? This is a 2-year investigation or a 2-year, you know, operation. And I will use a technical term here, Stephen. But did the top brass not get the collie wobbles? You know, when we got into say month 18, or were they? I mean, there's 50,000 hours of recording there. Didn't they think at like 30,000 hours? Okay, we've got enough to get him. Or was that the point where he was opening up and saying, well, you know what I did back in the day? Because, you know, criminals, they do like to, especially if they're feeling relaxed and, you know, with amongst their peers, they do like to sort of, you know, tell tales about what they got up to in their previous career.
Well, that's absolutely right. And of course, that was his defense. His defense was that it was a load of rubbish and that he was just bragging and et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, I mean, that's a good point you make, actually, Giles, because I don't know personally the man that was in overall charge of Operation George, and he was actually the officer in charge of the Rosemary Nelson murder inquiry. I've tried to contact him, but he seems to have dropped off the face of the planet. A man called Colin Port, and he was in charge. And as my co-author says, and we say in the book, that this man had balls of steel. And to go on for 2 whole years at great expense, recording Jimmy. Obviously, there did come a time when Colin Steele said, okay, enough is enough. He's not mentioned Rosemary Nelson, or when it has been mentioned, he's in complete denial. We're not going to get any further. Let's wrap it all up. We've now got a case file, which obviously they sent to the CPS, and they've got 48 terrorist offences, including murder, which they think they can get a conviction on. So, you know, let's call it a wrap. So, you know, that's obviously what happened.
Was there a dramatic moment then? And you've spoken with, you know, your co-author on this. Was there a dramatic sort of moment of, you know, aha, you could almost call it a Scooby-Doo moment. Aha, you're not who we think we are. You know, that's the big reveal. Or is it a lot more, is a lot more mundane than that? You just suddenly turn around and go, by the way, you know, you sir, are nicked, basically.
Well, no, there wasn't really, because, you know, Jimmy wasn't arrested by, Jim Fulton wasn't arrested by any of the undercover team. He was arrested by local police, an armed firearms team from Devon and Cornwall. And he was arrested at his home early one morning in Plymouth. And then he was helicoptered straight out of the country, straight to Northern Ireland, to a holding centre. And it was only the interview room at the holding centre that RUC, as it was then before the PSNI, the RUC revealed to him that eventually in the disclosure interviews, that the people that he'd been working for in Plymouth were in fact undercover police officers. Well, that was the moment of the Scooby-Doo moment for him. You know, what? So, you know, the undercover officers themselves, you know, weren't present to see the look on his face, but I'm sure they can all use their own imaginations.
Exactly. I mean, it's a job brilliantly done, but the officers did put themselves at considerable risk, because we're talking about terrorists here, and we're talking about, you know, the lawless terrorists, who are a particularly vicious bunch, aren't they?
Well, that's absolutely true, and yes, they were at risk, and I've got every admiration for them. I mean, it's a complete kettle of fish to my own undercover days, which were history now back in the 70s, and these people that my co-author was mixing with and the other officers, I've got every admiration for them, because you're right, the LVF people, Jim Fulton, et cetera, et cetera. And Mark Swinger Fulton was actually a visitor to Plymouth and was in their company for at least one night, excuse me, on the Pop in Plymouth. And, you know, anything could have happened. You know, if they'd have been discovered, you know, it might have been Kearns for them. So, yes, it was extremely, extremely dangerous. And, you know, there were other connections of Jim Fulton's in England at that time, other LVF connections other than the woman that I've mentioned. So, you know, he could have easily got hold of firearms, knowing his background, and done something drastic to these officers.
Presumably, when Fulton was lifted, was the woman in Plymouth, was she arrested for something as well? Did she come into contact with this gang? Because she would have known that, yeah, you know, the gang, and thinking they're a real gang, because otherwise she might have been able to give descriptions to, you know, you to loyalist colleagues.
She was the introducer. If you remember, I was saying right early on in the interview, she was the introducer. She initially was in the B&B at Plymouth and then moved to Cornwall. And she introduced Jim Fulton to Neil, the leader of the criminal gang in Plymouth. When she was arrested, she was actually on holiday in Portugal when Jim Fulton was arrested in Plymouth. So I think it was about a week, 2 weeks later after Jim Fulton's arrest, she was arrested along with other members of her family when she returned to the UK from Portugal. And she ended up in Paddington Green Police Station being interviewed there before she was transferred over to Belfast. But she, in some ways, you know, she was a lucky woman because she was charged with at least one, I think it was just one count of murder, the murder of a young council worker in Lurgan in County Armagh. Adrian Lamphy was called, and he was shot dead. You know, close range shooting, and she was a witness to that. She witnessed the immediate aftermath, and she was charged with murder, but acquitted of murder, but convicted of destroying evidence in relation to that particular murder. So, in some respects, she was a very lucky lady. She ended up being sentenced to 8 years, no doubt served for, instead of a life sentence for murder. So, it was quite fortunate, really.
Do you think, I mean, this was an undercover sting. How did you come about it? And do you think, I mean, presumably, will we see that sort of sting again? I mean, that came out successfully. But it was a risky undertaking, both in terms of physically to the officers involved and obviously to the whole service. Because if it had gone AWOL, then there would have been tremendous repercussions on that sort of operation taking place again.
Well, yeah, I mean, in answer to your second part of that question, I would have to say my own feelings are that I doubt very much that we'll see an undercover sting of the same magnitude again, because even if it's just from a cost point of view, you know, it must have been terrifically expensive. So there's always a cost thing to be budgeted in. And in relation to how did I come across it, you interviewed me some time ago about my Operation Julie book, and there was a podcast, True Crime Investigations UK, last year, and it was a four-part podcast about Operation Julie. I was talking on it. Mark Dickens, my co-author, he heard this podcast, and he made contact with me. And then we started chatting, and he was telling me the story about Operation George, and I did my own research, and I thought, wow, this is a really interesting story. And I always wanted to write a second true crime book. So when he contacted me about Operation George, it kind of fell into my lap in some ways. And I'm very thankful to him. He's probably listening, so I've got to say that.
The book, we're going to run out of time. The book is called Operation George, A Gripping True Crime Story of Audacious Undercover Sting. It's by Mark Dickens and Stephen Bentley, who we'll be speaking to again. And good to have you back on the show. If people want to find more information about you or about any of the other books that you've written as well, where can they find you, Stephen?
Yeah, the easiest way is just go to my website, which is Stephen, spelled with a PH, StephenBentley.info.
The book is called Operation George. It's by Mark Dickens with Stephen Bentley. Stephen, it's been a pleasure to have you on the show again, and hopefully we'll speak in the future.
Yeah, that'd be nice. Thanks for having me.